and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and internet and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel. I'm your host. On today's program, the future of the internet and our media. They're on the line, and it's all wrapped up in an issue called network neutrality. Who will determine what you can watch, what you can listen to, what you can read, and what you can send over the internet? That is the topic of today's show. We're going to listen to some testimony from the Senate Commerce Committee, which recently held a hearing on the issue. And we'll also hear from some very smart defenders of the public interest in all of this. So you will want to stay tuned. The internet depends on it. So the notion of network neutrality is one that we've been talking about here in the Media Geek radio show for many weeks now, going back. So if you've been listening at all, you've heard it brought up. You may have heard it even last week when I spoke to Ben Scott, who is a policy director for Free Press, which is a media reform group. And underneath this sort of wonky-sounding term is really the future of the internet. Right now, the internet providers in the U.S. have been winnowed down over the last few years, such that most people are getting their internet access from a local cable company, such as a giant like Comcast, or they're getting it from one of the largest telephone companies in the country, such as Verizon, AT&T, or Bell South, or Quest. And in fact, what we have right now when it comes to telephone and telecommunications, it looks a lot like the 1980s all over again. When AT&T was broken up into the regional Bell monopolies, they broke up, they reformed, there was competition in some cases, and now they've recombined. And in all of this moving about, what they'd love to do is to start having more control over that new data pipe that goes into your home and to determine how much you pay to get what and whether you'll get relatively inexpensive video programming exclusively provided by AT&T or Verizon, who might become your new cable TV company as well, or whether you might pay more if you want to get video programming from somebody else, and maybe whether or not they'll go charge somebody else like Google or Yahoo, or maybe even your community radio station might get charged for providing you with their Airstream through the internet connection, which you're already paying for. The stakes are very high. And it is not just the internet, since with this notion of convergence, as things become digital, more and more these lines, these internet lines, are going to be used to provide you with television, with radio, with your newspaper, with all this other content. And that is what is being debated right now in the halls of Congress in the year 2006. So we're first going to hear from some testimony given at a Senate Commerce Committee hearing on network neutrality that happened on the morning of February 7th. 2006. And so we're going to hear what several representatives of industry, as well as some of our elected representatives, had to say about this issue, about the future of the internet. And throughout today's program, you're going to hear some terms you may or may not be familiar with. And so I thought I'd go ahead and provide some definition to them so you don't get lost. We'll talk a lot about the word broadband, which most people probably have heard, and that generally refers to the larger internet pipes that can go into your home over DSL or over cable, broadband working at a much higher rate than what you can get over your basic modem connection. So we'll be talking about bandwidth. Bandwidth is the amount of data that you can put down your internet pipe, your DSL or cable. And it's often expressed in a term called MBPS, or megabits per second, and that's how much data you need. So you'll hear numbers like 100 megabits per second or 54 megabits per second bandied about quite a bit in this next half hour. And you need to understand that the more you have means the better kind of data you can get. It means the better, richer media that you can get. So like a DVD quality video is like 5 megabytes per megabits per second. A lot of stereo audio like an MP3 is 128 megabits per second. And so most people who have DSL in this country or cable get about 1 megabit per second, which is enough to get decent quality video, decent VHS quality video, nearly DVD quality video depending on the type of a connection that you have there. And definitely good enough to get stereo audio through your internet, but not good enough for high definition television, not good enough to get a lot of bigger things. And that's most people in the country top at about 1-2 megabits per second. And so you'll hear that number bandied out quite a bit. You'll also hear talk of this notion of quality of service. And quality of service is a notion in the world of networking, the world of computers, where it's a matter of how does a particular network guarantee that certain types of data make it through in a certain way. And in the internet, generally, there's a very low quality of service, meaning all data is treated the same. It pretty much, they try its best to get it to you. In a quality of service model, often that means that some types of data, it might be voice data, it might be audio data, video data, other types of data, would be given some priority. The network would give it sort of like, if you imagine it like an intersection, would give it the green light, while it'll give other things the red light. So you'll hear those topics and those concepts mentioned quite a bit here as well in the program. So let's now go to that Senate Commerce Committee hearing. And first we'll hear from Senator Byron Dorgan, who is a Democratic senator from the state of North Dakota. And I chose to listen to him first because I thought he had some very interesting comments on the issue of network neutrality. And he really comes at it sounding quite a bit like your average consumer.
I think this is one of the most important hearings that we will hold this year in this committee. And I was eating some Cheerios this morning, Mr. Chairman, when I read the business section of the Washington Post. It says, Verizon executive calls for end to Google's free lunch. Well, my Cheerios weren't free, but apparently my lunch was going to be free. The Verizon communications executive accused Google Inc. of freeloading for gaining access to people's homes using a network of lines and cables the phone company spent billions of dollars to build. I've had both DSL and broadband from cable. Consumers pay for both of those. I paid for the opportunity to have DSL and cable broadband, and this is not a free lunch. The reason I would have paid that is I want access to the content that exists. And I really believe that net neutrality is a very important concept.
And that was Senator Byron Dorgan, who is a Democrat from North Dakota, giving his opening comments about network neutrality, specifically referring to comments that he read in the press and that I've reported here on Media Geek about how Verizon and AT&T, the two biggest telephone operators in the country who don't compete with each other, have the country divided up into geographic regions again, how they, along with Bell South, have been saying that Google, Yahoo, and all of the other companies providing internet services are actually freeloading on their bandwidth, which consumers are paying for. Next up, we're going to hear from Vinton Cerf. He is the so-called internet evangelist for Google, but his real fame comes from the fact that he helped invent the internet. And this is what he had to say to the Senate Commerce Committee.
I was fortunate to be part of the original team that designed and built the internet. We've learned some lessons from its design over the last 30 years. The first lesson is that it was structured as a layered architecture like a layer cake. Certain parts at the bottom were for physical transport of bits moving over wires or over optical fibers or over radio channels. The next layers up supported packet switching. The next layers up beyond that supported the actual transport of information. These various layered structures allowed for changes in underlying transmission systems and switching systems over the course of a 30-year period. So new kinds of technology could be integrated into the system and everything still worked. More critically, we had an end-to-end principle which said most of the intelligence in the network was at the edges of the net where all of the applications were implemented. The core of the network was fairly stupid, actually. It just moved packets back and forth like little electronic postcards. The overarching rationale for all of this was to make the system completely open and completely distributed with no central control. What we have today is innovation without permission. For example, Tim Berners-Lee, in the invention of the World Wide Web, did not have to ask permission of any ISP to invent this new and wonderful idea. The challenge we have is that there isn't enough competition in the broadband world. If there were enough competition, you wouldn't have me sitting here expressing these concerns.
That was Vinton Cerf, VP and Internet Evangelist for Google and one of the originators of the technologies that created the Internet. Next up, we'll hear from the telecom industry itself. We'll hear from Walter McCormick, who is the president and CEO of the United States Telecom Association. and that association does represent such companies as Verizon and AT&T. He tells the Senate Commerce Committee their position on the notion of network neutrality.
Senator Dorgan really began this hearing by asking, is our internet going to change? And so I want to be clear about the position of our companies. Our companies have a 100-year tradition of connecting people to each other over our networks. We are 100% committed to continuing this tradition. Our commitment to our customers, our commitment to you is this. We will not block, impair, or degrade content, applications, or services. That is the plainest, most direct way I know to address the concerns that have been raised about net neutrality. Now, how can you be assured of our commitment in the absence of a legislative mandate? Well, first, you can be assured of this commitment because our culture, our history, our business has been focused for more than a century on connecting our customers with those they choose. Second, because there already exists oversight by the Federal Communications Commission. The FCC's oversight has proven to be effective. The commission has made it clear that it has the authority and the appetite to move swiftly to intervene to protect consumers. And finally, because consumers aren't experiencing any problems today, and there isn't any statute in place, there isn't a problem that Congress needs to address.
And that was Walter McCormick, who is the CEO of the United States Telecom Association, which represents the nation's largest telephone and telecommunications providers like AT&T and Verizon. Finally, the last bit of testimony we'll hear from the Senate Commerce Committee hearing on network neutrality is from Earl Comstock. He is the CEO of CompTel, which is also a lobby and industry association, but it represents the competitors to the largest companies. Mostly these are regional and small telephone and telecom operators. And this is what he had to tell the Senate Commerce Committee.
What the Bells are doing and what the cable companies have already done is engineer their networks to create scarcity so that they can then manage the network in a way that favors their content and services. Today, the Internet 2, which you'll hear from later on today, they are building the next generation network. They have been since 1995. And what they discovered through their own research, looking at this question of quality of service, which you hear a lot about, is that the answer to quality of service is bandwidth. And the reality is that you don't need quality of service, that what you want is an internet that does precisely what Mr. Cerf said. It's very simple. It's very robust in that sense. It doesn't favor one service over the other. It's all best efforts. And as long as you have the bandwidth, that's not a problem. Other countries today, consumers in other countries today, can get 100 megabits a second. Millions of university students today can get 100 megabits a second. And all of you know universities are not rolling in cash, yet they're able to come up with the ability to get to the desktop in dormitories, just like a small community, 10 megabits, 100 megabits, and sometimes more. So it's just fascinating to me that we're reinventing the wheel here. And once again, you're being presented with promises. I will say the Bell companies seem to be the best at making the promises and the worst at keeping them. If you review many of your states, if you look back, they promised to build out a broadband network 12 years ago. In California, for example, they committed to building out a network by 2005. It was going to get 45 megabits to every consumer. They haven't met that promise by a long shot. And this is a fight about who's going to control innovation. Is it going to be controlled by a few network operators, the gatekeepers on the internet, or is it going to be controlled by the devices at the edge and therefore allow innovation throughout the country?
And that is Earl Comstock. He is CEO of CompTel, which represents the competing and small telecom operators, small meaning not Verizon, AT&T, Bell South, or Qwest. So I actually believe Qwest is a member of CompTel, being one of the largest of the small. Speaking to the Senate Commerce Committee hearing on network neutrality, which was held February 7th, 2006. And you're listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media. And today, especially, a look, a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandel, and I'm your host. And today, we're all looking at network neutrality, the future of the internet, the future of our media right now, bouncing around the halls of Congress. And again, as you heard there, as you heard Mr. Comstock mention at the end of his testimony, there are countries elsewhere, such as Japan, such as South Korea, which get connections to the internet running at 45 megabits per second for $50 a month. That is roughly, depending on where you are, 23 to 45 times the speed which you're getting by your cable or DSL connection, for which you pay anywhere between $12 and $50 a month. 23 to 45 times faster. And that's even faster than the amount of data that you're actually able to send through the network, because most DSL connections and most cable connections in the U.S. give you much more data coming to your computer than can be sent from your computer. So if you want to upload things like your own podcasts, your own videos to a website, or send it to your friends, you're sending it at a third fewer, slower speed than you usually have, usually around one third of a megabit, to just put this all in perspective. To get even more perspective, today, which is our airtime on WEFT, February 10th, 2006, I had the opportunity to participate in a conference call put on by Free Press, the media reform organization, where they were hoping to connect up bloggers and independent media makers with some influential thinkers about the public interest, but specifically about this issue of network neutrality. So we were able to hear from Larry Lessig, professor of law at Stanford Law School, the founder of the School Center for Internet and Society, one of the co-founders of the Creative Commons Project. He has written books like Free Culture, The Future of Ideas, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, and is really one of the smartest and most articulate defenders of the public interest with regard to our rights online. So what we're going to listen to right now is his opening comments about the issue of network neutrality and breaking down what are some of the really important and salient points of this issue.
I think it's really important to make sure that this issue is framed in a way that is historically true, because most of the debate around it is just historically false. So the typical way in which this issue gets framed is a question about whether we should have new regulation of the internet. And the first incredibly important point to recognize is that what's happened here is not that people have called for new regulation of the internet. What's happened is that there's been a radical change in the underlying regulatory infrastructure for telecommunications. For the last 40 years, there's been a basic principle that, roughly translated today, we can call this neutrality principle, governing telecommunications law. And literally last August, the FCC took the final steps to remove those principles of neutrality from any part of the broadband network. That principle had not applied to cable, but last year the FCC removed it for DSL as well. So DSL and cable are both free of this principle of neutrality that has historically governed telecommunications networks, and that neutrality principle has been central to guaranteeing that outsiders could begin to build new applications and content for the internet. For of course, you know, think about all of the great innovators in the history of the internet, from Tim Berners-Lee developing the World Wide Web from Switzerland while working at CERN, to HTML mail, Hotmail, developed by an Indian immigrant, to ICQ, first instant peer-to-peer instant messaging chat, developed by an Indian, by a Israeli high school student, to Napster, developed by a bunch of college undergraduates, to search engines like Google and Yahoo, developed by Stanford students. All of the major innovations in the history of the internet are by outside, non-Americans and kids, right? These are outsiders, and that's because the architecture of the internet, embedding this value of end-to-end neutrality, invited outsiders in to innovate. Now, that's threatened. That's threatened by this change, because what will happen when this principle of neutrality is removed from the network is that the network will increasingly auction off the highest value chunks of the broadband network to the highest bidders. And what that will do is mean that the next generation applications and services will find it harder to compete against today's applications and services. So there's no doubt that this change will reduce application competition on the internet. And that's one final point I want to make. There's a lot of debate about competition to build out broadband. And that's one important question: how do we get companies to build broadband infrastructure? And so far, we've failed. We are in penetration. We are now 16th in the world for broadband penetration, and that's an embarrassment, especially given the prices and the quality. But there's a distinct question from broadband competition, which is application and service competition. What sorts of products are available on the internet? What kind of services? What video? And keeping application competition open is the key to preserving the innovation and growth of the internet. And that's exactly what the threat to neutrality, net neutrality, would undermine. There would be weakening of application competition, and that's what would chill and slow development, especially for people who don't happen to have $10 billion to spend on securing access to the internet.
That was Professor Larry Lessig of Stanford University giving his introductory remarks about the issue of network neutrality during a conference call with bloggers and other independent media makers hosted by Free Press on that issue. Next up, we'll hear the opening comments of Jeff Chester from the Center for Digital Democracy.
Well, we need you because we need you to encourage a real debate. We need Congress to step in now and to help save the Internet's democratic and competitive potential. But Congress may not act or do nothing because the big cable and telephone companies certainly do not want Congress to come in now and say, preserve an open Internet. The future of the Internet and our entire digital media environment, I believe, is at risk with profound implications for democracy, civic participation, dissent, and equity. And the AOL's announcement of charging a quarter cent per email is just the tip of the iceberg about the plans to begin imposing a whole raft of schemes both on users and on content providers as cable and the telephone companies begin to fully monetize the Internet experiment. The Internet, it's very important to recognize that the cable and the telephone industry have successfully led a political campaign to get to this place, as Professor Lessig was referring to. They specifically wanted to undo the public policies that supported the open end-to-end architecture that Professor Lessig and others have talked about, that's been at the core of the possibilities for the Internet. Michael Powell did this for them, primarily at the FCC. They have a huge incentive now to discriminate because the government has now created, as a result of their lobbying, a broadband monopoly controlled by either cable or the telephone companies. And if you go on my website or other sites, you will see the technology plans by Cisco and others, business models that allow them to do a quality of service monetization of packet delivery, charging more for some applications than others. I think one of the most important things, though, is what their vision is, what the big cable and phone companies, what their vision is for the future of broadband. And it's really about video. It's really about television. It's the next generation of television. They want to ensure that their video-oriented bits for programs, rich media advertising, and other multimedia applications receive priority. It's the economics of show business, I'm afraid, that's going to determine much of the future of the Internet unless we have a successful public interest intervention now. But the further monetization of Internet content will have profound implications for commercial and non-commercial communications, let alone privacy. So I hope we can have a serious debate here and determine what the Internet's destiny will be.
That was Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy, giving his opening comments about the issue of network neutrality during a telephone conference with bloggers and other independent media makers hosted by Free Press on that issue. I got the opportunity to ask a question, which Lessig answers.
I actually want to take things back to the area where a lot of bloggers live and a lot of podcasters live, because as someone who hosts a program on radio stations and distributes online, I already pay for my internet service. I already pay a lot to get the bandwidth I need to distribute my program. And so it's about the so-called free lunch that Google gets that apparently I'm getting. I'm worried, one, about the costs that might be passed on to me if I want to see things go out. But I'm also worried is, can it also be used as a political gatekeeper so that, you know, maybe Google can go cut a good deal with Verizon. But what about me? What about the person who's distributing information that challenges the status quo? What about indie media? What about, you know, bloggers who are out there pushing these buttons? will we be able to get the same deals, or will we be essentially cut out because our prices are going to be higher because we're not Google?
Yeah, I think that it's important to think about the incentives here in a world where access tiering happens. So the incentive of the media companies that would buy fast lane access is not only to guarantee themselves enough access, but also to make it so that people who aren't paying for high-speed access don't have high-quality access on the Internet. So there's two incentives going on, one to guarantee themselves and also to block others. And I think that's exactly what you would see happening. So think about the emerging market for video services, right? So Google is on our side in this issue. In one sense, if access tiering happened, then services like Google Video would have an obvious advantage over services like YouTube, .com or URTV, because Google would be in the position to buy Fastlane access and those other services as startups wouldn't. And this is the critical point to recognize. Every major success story on the Internet started with zero, right? eBay was just a bunch of servers, the same thing with Google, the same thing with Yahoo, the same thing with Amazon. They started with zero, and the Internet invited them to be competitors and become successful. What the future will look like is that to start on the Internet in a way that really would make it possible for you to succeed, you got to pay a tax to get on. And the point is, if the tax is high, then fewer people will be able to compete, there'll be less innovation, and it'll be more protection for the people who are the successful people right now.
Jeff Chester from the Center for Digital Democracy also offered his take on how the big telecom companies may be able to discriminate against small and critical voices.
But I also think, I don't think it's likely, I don't think they'll ever, deliberately slow you down or block you, but I do think that you have a point, that if you offered news and analysis which the cable and telephone gatekeepers dislike, that I wouldn't expect you to get the kind of negotiation that would be beneficial to getting you a fair price and getting you on. That's why we need to have safeguards here and think about all this early on. Otherwise, we'll simply be blocking the access the American public has to news, public affairs, and commentary.
Jeff Chester from the Center for Digital Democracy. You can find them on the web at digitaldemocracy.org. And we heard from Professor Larry Lessig as well, talking about the future of our internet, which is the future of our media, who will control it, who will be able to speak, who will be able to listen. And we heard from them through a conference call organized by Free Press, the media reform group. You can find them at freepress.net, which they arranged between these fellas and a bunch of bloggers and independent media makers to help spread the word about the issue and perhaps get you, the public, riled up to talk to your legislators and to make a fuss that you want control over your internet. You want everything you pay for, and you want it not to change. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at Radio.MediaGeek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at MediaGeek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowow. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.